Hey, and welcome back to the Prepare Podcast. The Prepare Podcast is a Salvation Army podcast where we invite women of faith and in ministry to share their experiences and wisdom to prepare and equip us in our faith pursuits and callings. I'm your host, Sarah McCullough, and this month's guest is a Rise and Shine Women's Conference keynote speaker, Jo Saxton. Jo Saxton is an author, speaker, leadership coach, church planter, and visionary who empowers women, challenges societal stereotypes, and helps people discover who they truly are by seeing themselves the way God sees them. Jo is really excited to be with us at Arise and Shine, so enjoy getting to know her better on this month's episode. Thanks for tuning in. Hi, Jo Saxton. Welcome to the Prepare Podcast.
Hi.
So glad you're here. And our ladies are so excited about our conference in October, Arise and Shine Women's Conference. And we're just thrilled that you could be on the Prepare Podcast, where we meet with women of faith and in ministry to learn from them to help prepare and equip us in our faith pursuits and callings. So thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. Yay. It's great to be with you.
Some of our listeners know you if they were at the Regeneration Young Adult Conference in 2015 that our territory, the Salvation Army Central Territory, every year out in Wisconsin. So if any of our young adult women or some of our leaders were there, they'll know you, but you're new to a lot of us. So I'm going to ask you just to introduce yourself. Tell us who Jo Saxton is.
Great, thank you. Well, like many of your listeners, I'm a woman who wears a number of hats and different things. So in terms of background, I'm a Brit and a Nigerian. My parents are Nigerian. I grew up in London in England. I am married. I have two daughters who are tween ages, kind of middle school age. And right now I live in Minneapolis. I've lived in the States about 14 years. In terms of professionally, I chair the board of an organization, a nonprofit called 3D Movements, which comes alongside churches as they seek to make discipleship and mission part of everything they do. I co-host of a podcast called Lead Stories. I write books, recently released one called The Dream of You. And what else do? And I speak, yes. I speak and teach, and I train and do a lot of leadership coaching as well.
Great. You're the perfect fit for our conference. You might know that 50 women are receiving their own copy of The Dream of You because they are part of our launch team to help promote our conference.
Oh, wow.
So these ladies, we have this like private Facebook group where I'm sharing these team tasks with them, and they are so motivated and excited, and they're so eager to receive that book in the mail. So our ladies are going to be just ready to receive you October 12th when we meet together at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare.
Wonderful.
You know, we want to learn from your experiences to prepare us. So, you know, as I was getting more familiar with you, looking at your website says that you empower women. So my follow-up to that is, when did you feel a calling in your life to empower women, and how are you doing so? And who first empowered you?
Okay. So in terms of feeling a calling, I would say it's pretty recent, to be honest. Growing up in England with the church in that environment, there's not really a kind of women's ministry type thing there, or at least there wasn't when I was growing up. There's probably a couple of things now, but there wasn't when I was younger. So I felt called to leadership, and in much of my leadership life was mainly leading men. And I think the sense and the desire to focus more specifically on women came out of the fact that I got kind of tired of being the only one there, or one of the few there, or seeing the same old faces and stuff. And much as I loved those same faces, I knew there were many other women who were called to lead. And I knew that there were many other women who had passions and things in their hearts. And so I think it was when I moved to the States and I'd started speaking again. And again, it was the lack of seeing other women around that I think I began to ask a few more questions, and I began to get feedback from people who were looking for mentors and looking for ways to develop in leadership. And I'd often meet them at conferences and they'd be weeping about just the lack of investment or opportunity or environments for them. And so some of it was, I think, initially that kind of arrogant thing that, well, maybe not everybody does, but I do, where it's like, somebody needs to do something about this. Somebody needs to make something happen. And And I would recommend people and all that kind of stuff. But I looked after a close look, realizing that there were a number of stepping stones for women as leaders that weren't always available. And so for me, it felt like my next call in terms of my call to equip leaders was to focus on women. So I've always felt called to equip leaders. I've always felt called to invest in leaders. It just felt like in this chapter, however long it lasts, women are the focus of that. And so what it looks like in practice is it has a lot to do with discipling women who lead, encouraging women who lead, do some coaching, have a couple of gatherings, developing an initiative called the AZA Collective, which basically looks at women who lead and how we can inspire them, invest in them, and ignite them for impact. Because often women leaders find themselves in that position where there aren't many people like them, and it can be quite lonely and quite challenging to work out how to be their God-given selves in leadership. And since we lead from the inside out, I found that a number of women were kind of self-editing, and it was impacting their proficiency, their excellence, their calling, their gifting, all of that, because they'd already taken themselves out of the game internally because they weren't sure whether the Lord wanted them to lead. So that was one of the things that really impact that I've realized is a really important thing to focus on when empowering women. So coaching in a few gatherings and stuff, and gathering women into a community of leaders so that they can look around and see one another and not feel so alienated for being alone. Because if you're the only one, sometimes you wonder whether you should be the only one in terms of whether you should be there at all. And as for who empowered me, I think there were multiple people over the years. I think you can get empowered or inspired from a distance when you see people doing what you're doing. And though I didn't see many, but whenever I did see somebody, it was an encouragement. I think in practice, I'd say people like my teachers at school. I actually feel like I was the last one to work out I was a leader. I think my teachers had worked it out. My youth group leaders had worked it out. People at Bible college had worked it out. Everybody, I was just slow. I was looking elsewhere. I was the last to know. And they empowered me by encouraging me, and they empowered me by giving me creative environments in which I could learn and fail, and by giving me opportunities as well.
I heard you just say allowed you to fail. I think that's such an important thing for leaders and potential leaders to be aware of, is there's going to be times when you fail.
Absolutely. It's huge. And I think it's really huge for women as well, because I think if there aren't many of you, if you feel like you're the only woman there, the only woman of color there, and you're representing, you feel like if you get it wrong, then it shuts the door for everybody. And sadly, people fear that, because that's happened before, you know? So I think it's important for us to know that part of our leadership development means we're allowed to grow, and growth is messy. And growth sometimes means we don't do as good a job on certain things, but it doesn't disqualify us either.
Right. As I think when you're praying, about these steps that you're taking, when you fail, you might interpret that as a door being closed by God, but that's not necessarily true, right?
Absolutely. I think failing is part of what we do. You know, I think, and also sometimes the things that we lead aren't going to go well, but faithfulness is the success that we want. Have we been faithful to what God asked us to do? Have we been committed to what he asked us to do? And actually failing is an integral part of growing. You know, I often think of when my kids learn how to walk, and part of them learning how to walk involved them falling down, you know?
Yeah.
If you're a healthy parent or adult around them, you don't look at them and chastise them for not being able to run a marathon when they're 11 months. You celebrate the two steps. And I feel for us as leaders, and as we're encouraging people to lead, that we probably want to do more in terms of celebrating the two steps rather than focusing on whether somebody falls down on something, because it's actually that process that strengthens them and gives them the courage and the boldness, and the process, including the encouragement, gives them the boldness to keep on walking and keep on running.
It's so funny how we totally get that as we see these babies making those steps and knowing that cheering them on is a part of it, and then somehow we forget that when it looks different when the people are older. Wow, that's such a good analogy. The other thing I saw on your website that I wanted to know more about is it says that your messages challenge listeners to engage in missional living and discipleship. So can you describe what that has looked like in your life And can you give some practical advice for our listeners to adopt that way of living?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's looked different in different chapters of my life, but I think it comes from the basic assumption that we're already a sent people, that God has already sent us. And so that, and if, well, not if, since he says the fields are ripe to harvest, the harvest fields are ripe, but the workers are few, that means out there, there are people, there are environments that are waiting, that are, they may not realize they're waiting, but that, mm-hmm. that are searching and hungry for God. And so as and so when I say missional, I mean, the irony is discipleship the way Jesus did it was missional. It's it in terms of when Jesus made disciples, it produced missionaries. It produced people who were sent ones who assumed that sending and going and communicating and living the ways of the kingdom of God and communicating the gospel was a natural way of life. I think in more recent years, discipleship has become an internal knowledge-based process. And so the reason why I even use the word missional is to remind us, I think the language is just to aggravate us outwards and to aggravate us back to reclaiming what discipleship actually originally was according to Jesus. And so for me in my life, it's always been asking the question, Lord, who are you sending me to and what does that look like? And there have been big sends and small sends. So I felt called, me and my husband felt called to America. You know, that was part of our calling. But actually in practice, some of the sending is my kids are of, like I said, they're teenagers and they've got friends and they're in and out of our house a lot. They're in and out of my car a lot on carpool. What does it look like to be sent to them and to be available to them and looking to see what God's doing in those families and who do we encourage? Who do we come alongside? Who do we build a relationship with over a over the period of years our kids are in school together, which is the next 6-7 kind of thing. Those are some of it. In other, there have been times when we've moved particularly to a specific neighborhood and a specific church. When we lived in Phoenix, we worked alongside Bhutanese refugees. And part of this, the being sent there was actually going into particular neighborhoods and looking to see who what we see in the New Testament described as the person of peace was. Look in Luke 10, and when Jesus sends out the 72, he says, look for a worthy person or a person of peace or a man of peace, the one who welcomes you, who's open to you, who serves you, and stay there. And so when we were in Phoenix, it was we were looking to see where the people of peace were, and it happened to be this refugee community. In other areas, when we lived in California for a while, that was a number of the mums at the school gate who were the people of peace. But I think for us as followers, if we're wanting to engage with missional living, with recognizing that we're sent and that God is inviting us to partner with him in the renewal of all things, and that we are the hands and the feet of the Great Commission. Do you know what I mean? That we've been sent to play our part in that. I would start by looking at the life you already have. If you don't have friends who don't know the Lord, you need to get out more. You just do, because yeah. it's kind of awkward, you know? Stop preaching to your friends who already agree with you, kind of thing on that front. But I would ask yourself, what does it look like to be to be sent in the life you already have? So are there people of peace there, people who are open to the gospel, who are open to who you are and what you bring? Are there relationships? And some of them are passing relationships and some of them are permanent ones. So sometimes I'll have a conversation on the plane with somebody and I may not be in touch with them again. And sometimes it's an opportunity to talk, to listen, or to pray with that person or for that person. So, but in my ongoing neighborhoods, these are relationships for years, so it takes a different tone and a different emphasis when you're with people for years. So, but I would encourage people to ask the Lord who the people of peace are. Ask him where he's sending you. He's more committed to this than we are. So we can anticipate he'll answer.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was a challenge, especially the neighborhood piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. The neighborhood one's hard. I mean, there's no...
Which it seems like it should be easy, but there is a challenge to it.
Yeah, and I think some of it is inconvenient. And ironically, in some ways, it should be the easiest low-hanging fruit. But sometimes it depends on your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, in our last neighborhood, we had certain neighbors who weren't really particularly sociable and they kept themselves to themselves, and others who were really open. Mm. So you go to the ones that are really open and start there, and you can pray blessing on the ones who aren't open. Mm. I think with our neighborhood, it's like, what are the rhythms of your neighborhood that are good touch points? Are there good touch points to engage with your community? Are there habits and things that they always do? And even if it inconveniences you, will you make room and time for it? Because otherwise, we're so important, recovering from our meetings. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Or we place such importance on needing downtime that we realize we're missing opportunities on communicating the gospel or just being present in the neighborhood for when those moments come. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to build the relationships in the neighborhood, haven't you? So when the moments come, you can be there.
Yeah. It's important to recharge, but also like don't completely check out. Be watching for those moments.
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, I find that a constant one for us because you do want to recharge. And I think our habit is to get out there and do the stuff, then retreat and just kind of run away from everything. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's a middle way.
Yeah. And Kristen Schell, she's going to share at our pre-conference about her experience in the neighborhood. And she even said, I haven't heard this part, but she was just saying how you have impacted her her ministry. So I'm excited to hear that bridge, how you've impacted her.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. We connected at I actually didn't know her at the point when she said I'd said something when I was speaking, but it's been wonderful to connect with her since to hear of how when we can encourage one another in things, what it gives us the courage to do.
Right.
You know, I think that's an important part of our walk with one another.
Yeah, and you encouraged me back at the Regeneration Conference because that was our very first time I shared about this small group program that we started here called Embrace. And I there was a video and then I came up for a few minutes and described it. And then when you were giving your message, you were affirming the message of Embrace and what Embrace could do. So I haven't forgotten that. And I really appreciated you hearing that and hearing its potential and speaking that to our people. So,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So,
that's
great. Going back, you were at that conference. And then this year at that same conference, we had Ian Cron Morgan as our guest.
Oh, nice.
And he was describing the Enneagram 8. And he quoted you with the following statement you made about the Enneagram helping in that self-discovery. You said it helps you essentially discover the you before the world told you who you were supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And when he said that, the whole room was like, oh. Like that really like resonated with everyone. So I was curious, what were the feelings and experiences behind that statement for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've realized, even from my childhood and stuff, that I think there are aspects of my personality that were often seen as too much or not outside the confines of what the social constructs were for women.
Yeah.
That might be a good way to say it.
Got it.
Politely. And I found myself often pushing up against those cultural expectations. And I think, I mean, for me, things like the Enneagram are a tool. I know they're not the gospel, but sometimes when you have had loads of junk thrown on you, you need tools to dig your way back out.
Yeah.
And what I found was really helpful was it helped me reconnect with what God was always saying to me, but was out of reach. You know, when he says in his word that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, it was out of reach because there were other people who defined what fearfully and wonderfully made looked like. But to be able to have tools that will help remind me of certain things, my strengths, my weaknesses, without accusation, without judgment, was a real freeing thing. Because then the weaknesses you can bring to the Father, you can yield those things and let them go. So I think that was the heart behind it. And I just think I ask that question a lot: who were you before anybody told you who you were supposed to be? Because so often there's a long answer. There's a long answer because the second question really is, and how do you find your way back? You know, and it's important for us to do. We have the gift of one life, and it would really be a shame if we spent all of it trying to be somebody else's.
Mm. That's like tearing off a Band-Aid kind of question, like trying to like dig, like who was I before people started kind of, like putting those expectations or those corrections, like, gosh, who was I even as a child? Like, what was my patterns and my ways and my methods?
Yeah, totally.
Oof.
And I think sometimes it does take some digging, because there's been a lot of socialization, or, you know, grief happens to you, a breakup happens to you, somebody mm-hmm. says something, those things happen to you, and our identities continue to form and shape. You know, the woman I am now is different from the woman I was when I was single, when I was a newlywed, when my kids were babies. Different things have shaped me. Our identities continually growing. We just mm-hmm. want to keep on being sure that it's growing into the fullness of what God created, mm-hmm. rather than a world away from that, because we're a living reaction to our past, mm-hmm. you know? So, it takes a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's healthy and wise for us to reassess every so often. I'm not saying every day, all day, but every so often for sure.
Yeah. Agreed. Now, in the beginning, I heard you share about that isolated feeling of being the only woman of color in these leadership circles.
Yeah.
Being a woman of color, what challenges have you faced in being a leader in the church?
Well, I think for me, a lot of the spaces I've been in have been white majority spaces. And that was, I felt called to that when I was a lot younger. I did not know the cost. I did not know what it would cost, because I think for me, it was diversity. It was me thinking heaven is going to be diverse and we've all got different things to bring. I'm seeking to learn from people who are not like me. What I didn't realize is that in many of those environments, that worked one way, not both ways. And so what was actually happening was assimilation, not actually bringing things to a wider environment. I think sometimes the loneliness of it, again, of trying to explain how I risk, there'd be an event in the news. I mean, this has happened more recently, but even from the early days, there'd be an event in the news in relation to race, and people wouldn't necessarily understand mm-hmm. why, how it impacted me, or and if I was the first person of color they'd come into close relationship, then there's a lot of processing that ends up happening, and it just gets tiring. I think being misunderstood in terms of, was I feminine enough, was something that came up a lot in certain spaces. Was I too loud? Was something that came up a lot in certain spaces. There are, what are the expectations that are spiritual and what are the ones that are cultural, mm-hmm. were things I had to process. And how do I become the person the Lord has wired me to be if I don't see many examples of what that looks like around me? Mm. And so it's been challenging. And then obviously, I mean, then there, you know, to put it bluntly, and then racism. Do you know what I mean? Just dealing with people's racism, whether they're microaggressions or beyond that, dealing with naivety, bigotry, expectations and stuff. And I mean, sometimes even well-meaning people saying, you know, when I see you, I don't see your color. And it's like, well, what do you see then? Because if you don't see my color, then you're not really going to understand my life.
Right.
You're not going to understand because I'm black every day. So therefore, how is this working for you? How is this working for you in every given environment? Because then if you don't see my color, you won't see the vulnerability I feel sometimes when I'm the only black person amongst hundreds of people. Mm. It won't occur to you to check in with me if you don't see that. If you don't see my color, what will it mean to you then when you hear racism? Mm-hmm. Will it impact you in some way? Do you know what I mean? I think and you won't get anything while I'm talking about then, will you? Because you don't see that. What do you see? Mm-hmm. What have you chosen to see, and what have you chosen to push aside? So there's been it's an ongoing process, but it's been an interesting one, to say the least.
Wow. I'm sure those conversations are hard to have. I mean, the last thing you said that made my head nod. It was like, wow, what you're choosing to see, because I think that's usually how it goes, like what we choose to acknowledge and choose to ignore.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people, and I sometimes think whether it's because we Christians aren't always that great at confronting things or difficult things or uncomfortable things, we assume ignoring puts it down. But actually, ignoring is as active as doing something. Mm-hmm. When you actively ignore, you minimize something. You minimize it in some way. But if you're ignoring the things that concern me culturally, then you're minimizing my experiences on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You think you're minimizing discomfort. You've actually created a whole lot more. Because now, are you a trusted relationship? Because are you never going to hear my fears or insecurities or how I feel walking down the street when I can tell somebody's staring at me because and I feel threatened? Or do you assume, oh, just ignore, one of the classic lines, just ignore it. It's like, why should I ignore aggression? Why should I ignore somebody and treating me differently for the color of my skin?
So there's not a conflict.
So that's not, and why does that make you feel uncomfortable? Uh-huh. Your body's not under threat. This is this is philosophical for you and actual for me.
Wow.
I'm trying to work out why you need to ignore this.
Wow.
Kind of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's been a fascinating it's been fascinating, and sometimes it's overwhelming. There's no doubt about it. Sometimes it's like and I'm out because it's not safe. It's not safe emotionally to have your real experiences minimized on a regular basis, and being it's just not healthy.
Now, being a female pastor, have other women ever negatively responded to your position?
Oh yeah, I remember seeing on social media, I'm not a Christian.
Boy.
I remember seeing that a little while ago. I thought, so, okay, all right then, darling. That's fine. she just said, you know, you're not a Christian because if you can't take the Bible at its word, then the Bible's really clear on women. So if you can't take the Bible at its word, you shouldn't be doing it. And I'm like, okay, thank you very much.
All right,
and
bye-bye.
I'm like, all right then. And yeah, so that tends to be the one, whether I'm not a Christian. Or whether I've got, I mean, I don't hear it much now because I don't put myself in environments where I found those conversations are very rare where you actually change somebody's mind.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I'm not changing my mind, so I'm not expecting you to either. I'm just more at ease with you not changing your mind than you clearly are with me. I remember there was one event I was at where a guy, and bless him, because he was actually trying to work through his process. And he said to me, he goes, Joe, I was really excited that you come in. I really enjoyed you speaking and stuff, and it really impacted me. And he had no problem with women speakers. And he goes, and then I heard you're a pastor, and it's really messed my head up now. He said, it's messed my head up because I don't believe in him, but it's kind of too late. And I just smiled and laughed and I said, good luck, love. I don't know like, what am I to tell you.
Good luck working that out.
I said, and he goes, so what am I going to do? And I said, well, I think you're going to have to wrestle with that. And it was good. I mean, it was really positive. He said, I'm not trying to be rude. And I could tell, you know, you can tell when someone's trying to, when it's going to be an antagonistic conversation with no fruit. But he was literally, he was like, please forgive me for even mentioning this, but it's just messed my head up completely now.
Wow.
And I thought, well, God bless your mess.
Oh, that's a good response. Well, this is important really for a lot of our leaders in the Salvation Army to be affirmed, and because we have women pastoring at Salvation Army churches, what we call CORE, Salvation Army CORE, by themselves. They're single women leading churches by themselves, and they need to continually be encouraged that they are in the right place. They're in God's will, and good things are to come. So thank you for affirming them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've got stuff to do.
Right.
It's important.
So can you share some unique advantages to being a woman in a pastoral role?
Suddenly my mind goes blank. I'm like, oh, what advantages are there? I mean, to be honest, it's weird because on some level, like there are some would say, you know, women can be more nurturing or greater listeners. And I'm none of those things. So I don't necessarily fit into that mold. I just think it's great because I think a woman's perspective, I think we're both male and female are made in the image of God. Therefore we bring things to the table. And so I think that alone is a positive reason. I think that alone, the fact that God has called you and has sent you is reason enough. That you bring something, but you do bring your gifts. You do bring your stories. Women make up half the sky. They need to see you. They need to see you. They need to see you leading. They need to receive the benefits of you. And as do the men.
Right.
As do our sons and our husbands and our brothers and our fathers and grandfathers and uncles. They need to see you. So I think that in some ways for me is reason enough. Whatever the mix of your giftings are, whatever your strengths and weaknesses are, the fact that you are God's child, made in his image, empowered by him for ministry. That's all good. That's good for me. That's good enough.
Yeah. You have a podcast. Can you tell our listeners about the theme of your podcast and the purpose and mission behind it?
Yeah. It's called Lead Stories, Tales of Leadership and Life. And I host it with a friend of mine called Steph O'Brien, who is a lead pastor here in Minneapolis. And, we became friends, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. I was initially mentoring her, and then we just kind of became friends anyway, regardless. And I think we were being nagged by people to start a podcast just because we were always having opinions. But I think, and we for us, it's a leadership podcast. Now, it has a very large audience of women, but it's actually not necessarily aimed at women. It's just aimed at equipping leaders. And we're particularly interested, though, in elevating the voices of the underrepresented, which often means that you are going to mm-hmm. elevate women and people of color, mm-hmm. because they tend to be in everywhere, the underrepresented voices. And our goal and our mission, so there's on one level, that's part of the mission, to elevate the voices of the underrepresented and to center their stories, because they, when we only have one dimension of leadership, who is it? It's Chimamanda Adichie who talks about this danger of a single story. And it's not that it's incomplete. It's not that it's inaccurate. It's incomplete. And I feel if our leadership stories and the only ones we're hearing are from one strata of society, it's incomplete. It's incomplete. And we have a big job to do. And so therefore, do you know what I mean? In terms of as leaders in our mission, whether that's in the church, in the workplace, wherever, we need to have available to us the voices of everybody, all leaders from all walks of life, for us to be better equipped to do it. And so that's part of what we love to do. And we just want to make sure that if there's someone who feels they're called to lead, and for us, we define leadership as being intentional with your influence. We want to take them on the journey of them being equipped in it, being resourced, not feeling they have to go to the latest conference, because not everybody can afford that. Not everybody's got time for that in every chapter of their life. We want to give them resources and access to things that we hope will help and serve them. And for both Steph and I, we're aware, obviously, that many women who are leading in different walks of life mm-hmm. don't often have accessible leaders to mentor them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this is our attempt at doing something from a distance, which would encourage someone and not feel quite so alone.
Yeah. Thank the Lord for technology. Really. It's just so great. Cause like you said, some people cannot afford to go to, you know, you pay for the conference, the hotel, all the things add up and the time away from your life, time off, family, like these kind of resources that we can access for free can be life changing.
Yeah, totally.
Now, looking back on your life, a little more history about Joe Saxton, was there another role or occupation you hope to be that you're not doing now? Like, you're a pastor, speaker, author. Was there something, was that what you always wanted to be, or was there something else that you aspired to?
Oh, gosh, yeah, I didn't want to do this at all. that's not my agenda. I wanted to write. I did want to write. I wanted to be a journalist. I said there was always the communication side of things. Mm. I didn't want to be a speaker. I did not want to be a pastor. I think the communication thing was always part of it for me. I wanted to write plays, actually. It was more the kind of fictional type of things that I wanted to do, that I wanted to report on. I liked the ideas of both writing plays and journalism.
Yeah. We know what you're saying. Yeah. Investigative. Is that it?
Yeah, that's the word. Thank you. It's a partnership, isn't it? Anyway. I wanted to do that sort of thing. Those are the things that, appealed to me most. I mean, obviously there were times when I was younger when I wanted to be Wonder Woman and when I wanted to be a disco dancer. But I kind of grew out of most of those. Most.
Still want to be that disco dancer, don't you?
Well, I was actually thinking Wonder Woman, but yeah, disco too. There's always a little bit of glitter in my life. A little bit of glitter. Well, glitter and a disco ball. You're never too far away from a disco ball, I find.
You're drawn to it.
Always.
It finds you.
Oh, like a magnet. My word.
So when we were sharing, going back again to our regeneration conference, I remember connecting with your stories of growing up as a young adult. You were describing a bit of a boy crazy experience. Yeah. True or false?
Yes. Boy drought and crazy. The extremes. It was all or nothing, really. So, often nothing, but all.
Well, we have a lot of young adult women that we minister to and love over here in the Central Territory of the Salvation Army. And it's a normal experience, right? But it can be very spiritually distracting. I can attest to that. So is there any advice that you can offer the young women facing those feelings, and any advice for the leaders as we love and encourage them?
I would say to the women, don't compromise who you are for what you want. Because what I found is when I minimized who I was for what I wanted, I didn't get it anyway. Mm-hmm. And also it's very conflicting. It's very conflicting when you put your personality in a box and you put your dreams in a box so that you make yourself more acceptable, because they're not actually receiving you. They're receiving a version of you. And eventually that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually. And it needs to, you know?
Yeah.
And I would say don't believe the lie that you sometimes might hear in your head or from others, that for you to embrace your calling means you could never, that it's marriage or ministry kind of thing, or it's marriage or leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Now you might have some dudes tell you that, but that just means that they need to just keep on moving and find somebody else rather than be with you. Do you know what I mean? You might have friends who tell you that. And I would say that friend is great for pizza and probably not for advice, you know, on that sort of stuff. And if you tell yourself that, it's a lie. It's just, you just need to know it's a lie. Now, on that, I would say the other piece of advice I'd say to somebody is, I think it pays to be self-aware. It pays to be self-aware where our ideals of people are actually idols that we've made, you know, in terms of, does it matter what color hair he has? No, it doesn't. He might not even have any within 10 years. So, you know, do you know what I mean? I think sometimes we set ourselves up either because we've been hurt before or because we've basically drank Disney all our lives to have these kind of idealistic versions of people.
Mm-hmm.
We want to judge somebody else by their results, but we want to be judged on our intentions. And it's a little awkward, that kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd encourage us to think of that. And I think to the leaders, I would say, are you creating cultures where this makes this stuff harder or easier?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Are you creating cultures where this is harder because we are not acknowledging the reality of what single life looks like today? Are we creating cultures where we're expecting men and women to behave in ways which are weird? You know what I mean?
Mm.
We're asking to be weirdos. I'm a firm believer. Maybe this is my paying it forward. I like matchmaking. I'm a big fan of matchmaking. There's a couple of weddings I've done which were the result of the matchmaking and stuff. Now, I don't mean busy yourself enough in people's business. I think some of it was of, I want to be, whenever I'm leading young adults, I want to create a culture that this is normal. This is okay. I'm not saying everybody you're going to date is going to be the person you met. I don't know that. I just know repression is bad for all of us. Do you know what I mean? And denial and pretending you don't like someone when you do, pretending you want to be single. You know what I mean? The amount of people who pretended they wanted to be single and then wondered why they were lonely. And I'm like, you've communicated for the past 5 years you want to be single.
That really wasn't. That's not really what their heart wanted.
You got your answers because they didn't want to appear. They didn't know how to be proactive. And on one level, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. But I think if we can create cultures of honesty and vulnerability on this stuff and fun, oh my gosh, it'll be messy because relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes because we just like discomfort and we just like mess, we have these other weird things in place which are subhuman. I mean, subhuman strategies. And I think it's healthier if we can create healthy cultures instead.
If you're single and your heart's not content with that, there's a pressure to find contentment, right? Like, I mean, in certain things, we do need to be content with what God's given us, right? Like, but the honesty of,
I am lonely,
like you said.
I think those things are important to identify because it'll come out sideways. I mean, there is the base level. We do have to say this as well. Jesus was complete as a single human being. And I think for us leaders, we need to remind ourselves of that as well. And it's, I'm almost contradicting what I'm saying. I'm like, create a culture which makes it easy, but don't make it an obligation or a law that for anybody to become a leader, they have to be married.
Right.
Because Jesus wouldn't qualify, would he? He wouldn't qualify to lead in your environment. And that's weird because he was, well, he is Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to be able to say to people, you don't have to be together with somebody as a demonstration that you're together as a human being, you know, that, that you can live a perfectly fulfilled life as a single person in community. Do you know what I mean? You can.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, if that's not what you want, if that's not what you hope for, and if you're being utterly honest, you'd like to be in a relationship with somebody that and get married, then you've got to be honest about that too.
Mm-hmm.
And engage with the process rather than waiting for a helicopter to drop somebody out of the sky and call it God.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it just doesn't work. We have to be realistic and honest about how that works too.
Yeah.
So I think honesty is valuable. Well, it's valuable, period. But it's important for us when we're engaging and celebrating people who are single, mm-hmm. and celebrating and engaging with people who don't want to be single anymore.
Right. And maybe even giving them the opportunity to say, like, okay, if you want to be in a relationship with someone, like, can I set you up?
Yeah, totally. It's like, if you want, I can arrange you to be at my house, and it's not going to just be two of you or anything. Do you know what I mean? Or,
yeah.
Or whatever. But I think we make so much of things which actually aren't in the Bible on this one. We've got to remember, in the Bible, marriages were arranged anyway. So it's like,
yeah, that's true.
You know, there wasn't a meeting across a crowded room all the time. And I think we spiritualize things which are our own insecurities as well. And this is me on the other side of marriage now. So I actually think this bit is the easier part. I mean, there's so much to deal with when you're doing life with somebody and, mm-hmm. and all of that. I just encourage us to get on with it where we can, whether mm-hmm. that is celebrating your single life or getting on with meeting people and dating and all that stuff.
Right. All right, Joe, as we're wrapping up, I just want to read the scripture to you and the listeners. It's our theme verse for Arise and Shine. Isaiah 60, verse 1. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. Any thoughts on that as you in the next, oh gosh, when is the conference? 8 months, 9 months away. It's a lot of time. But, you know, thinking of that verse, what could you draw from that you would want to communicate to our women to arise and to shine?
Yeah, I mean, I love that verse. I mean, Isaiah is my favorite. But I'm reminded of, I do think culturally we're in something of a moment for women, you know, in the world around us, in terms of the voices of the who have been women who've been abused and oppressed and assaulted and violated, the voices of women who are asking questions about leadership and being represented at every level so that the cultures they work in are healthier. I think we're in a moment for women who are marching. And I'm not saying we agree with everything or disagree with anything. I don't mean that. But we have to observe the world around us. Mm-hmm. And it would be great. It would be great if in this moment that we, as representatives of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, would rise. That we would rise with our voices, and we would rise, and not in some weird way. I just mean, the great thing about light is you don't have to pose. It's just on. The light is on. Mm-hmm. And I think we're needed at this time. And some of us will be saying me too as well. And some of us will be acknowledging our own broken pieces as well. But in these cultural moments, it's important that we're there. And that we're present, and that we show up, and that we shine. Because people need hope and life right now.
Yes. Good. I think – I just can't wait. It's just going to be such a great time together. And the lady – you know, the women we're engaging with on Facebook, on our event page, and they're just – they're excited, and they're ready to gather. When we started planning this, one of our team members, she gave us a really great challenge. And it's – I hope it's going to be her legacy that she says, let's pray for 2018 women to attend this conference.
Oh, wow.
In 2018. Awesome. So we're praying big, and we're dreaming big. And because typically this conference has only been – when we've done it previously, it's only been, you know, around 500 women. So we're praying big, and like you said, like this is a moment in time that we need to pay attention and step into the light and step into our moment to arise and shine for the glory of God, to point people back to Jesus, and let's equip our women and give them opportunity and the courage and confidence to do so.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. That's going to be fun.
It's going to be great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Joe, for giving me your time and giving our ladies your time and speaking to us and sharing about your heart, your ministry, and definitely inspiring and speaking truth to us.
Thank you. It's been fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again, Joe, for sharing with our listeners. Make sure you are following us on iTunes so you receive notifications for each month's episode. And if you think other women would enjoy the Prepare podcast, write a review for us. Don't forget to visit www.centralwomenarise.com to sign up for updates about our 2018 Women's Conference. Registration opens March 12th. If you want a text message reminder to register on March 12th, just text the phrase Arise and Shine, so A-R-I-S-A-N-D-S-H-I-N-E, all together, one phrase, Arise and Shine, to 51555. All right, see you next month.